So we're going to move right into the panel discussion. So could I invite the other two physicians who are speaking this morning, Dr. Kelleher and Dr. Hancock, to come up. And the moderator for this panel discussion, I would like to welcome Dr. Paul Gully. Dr. Gully is a public health consultant and adjunct professor at the University of British Columbia in the School of Population and Public Health. He provides advice to the BC First Nations community and health authority, and he worked recently as a consultant for the World Health Organization in the Ebola response in Sierra Leone. Dr. Gully was senior medical advisor in to the Deputy Minister of Health Canada in the past, and he was the Canadian representative on the executive board of the World Health Organization. He was seconded to World Health Organization from the Public Health Agency of Canada, where he'd been Deputy Chief Public Health Officer for Canada. Dr. Gully was an expert for us at Forum 2014, and we're thrilled that he has consented to moderate the panel discussion on healthy dying with Dr. Hancock, Dr. Kelleher, and Dr. Barwich. Dr. Gully, thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for allowing me to participate. I'll be brief. I want to encourage a dialogue, to encourage a discussion. If you can limit your questions, I don't really want your list of 27 interventions. Give me one. And then also, I'll ask the speakers to also limit their responses as well. So what you've had is from Dr. Hancock, how the Ottawa Charter, which I say has really stood the test of time, which is credit to Trevor and others, in terms of healthy public policy, and Dr. Keller, community action, and how we form compassionate communities and the social framework around that. And then Dr. Barwich, how we enable, in terms of BC, in terms of Canada, how we're enabling life completion. I like that phrase, an integrated approach to that. And then how it all wraps together in terms of the BC Palliative Care Center, in terms of a broader approach. So I'm sure there are questions. If not, I've got questions, as always. And but if you could come to the mics, of which there are two, and just quickly say who you are, and then either questions or comments to promote discussion. Thank you. First questioner.
My name is Catherine Millen. I'm with Family Caregivers of British Columbia. One of the things we touched on today was around cultural literacy, and also we touched on the importance of having dying well involves having certain controls, and one way of having some control is around personal planning and legal documents. However, my experience in BC, so we have the Ministry of Health 59-page document called My Voice. I have 2.5 university degrees, and there are certain pages in My Voice that make me go, what? And so my question is, do any of you have comments about this through function in BC? And or are you aware of any really simple documents or ways of doing this that we should know about?
Thank you. Maybe I'll ask Doris to start off with that.
So, two things. I think we're involved in some research right now, which is testing, and I don't think that the My Voice tool was ever really tested with a real-time audience, and so we are actually doing that to actually evaluate it against other tools. The second thing is that the minister shares your frustration with the tool and has asked that we at the center help with revising and making more simple tools available to the public in BC. We have a lot of people who are challenged in terms of their understanding, and it certainly isn't geared at that. And certainly I think as well, so two things around that is that I think we want to develop tools for the public that are more user-friendly and can be accessed in a number of ways online and that sort of thing, but also tools for healthcare professionals so that when you come to them that they know what to do with it and how to work that. So I think trying to look at a whole system approach around this. But yes, change is coming. Stay tuned. If you're interested in being part of the change, talk to me afterwards.
Thank you for the question.
If I can just add, I think that that's just one example of a broader issue that the Ministry of Health and the health authorities and the health professions in BC and across the country need to adopt a policy that you don't let stuff out that the public are going to read that hasn't been managed for health literacy.
Kevin? Do you have any?
I have some reservations about the whole idea of pushing advanced care planning globally anyway. I mean, it reminds me of the anti-smoking campaign. I mean, doctors have been asking their patients to stop smoking for over 100 years, to absolutely no avail. Part of the reason is to Part of the problems has been asking people to stop smoking in a group of people who, in the 50s, most surveys showed that didn't even know where their kidneys were. We've had success in the last 30 years because of the rise in health literacy and because of legislation at national level and workplace policies and a change, if you like, in the way in which we see ourselves as people and health. And smoking, giving up smoking, has fallen in that context. And so people can understand and access through their education and information, if you like, around health. And they get a sense of why they should be giving up smoking. Advanced care planning is the same. Now, we're pushing advanced care planning in a context where people have major trouble talking to each other about death and dying. Most people don't understand, and there's quite a lot of people don't understand the use of antibiotics at the end of life. You're asking people to make decisions about things that even educated people struggle with. And then you throw into that a bureaucratic framework that doesn't even consult with the community, and you have the recipe for what's old-fashioned called a nightmare. And then people are rather surprised why this should be. Without death education literacy, advanced care planning will always be on the back foot. What we really need is to change and to encourage widespread public education around death, dying, and loss. And then advanced care planning will make sense and then people will adopt it.
Thank you. I think one of the challenges, I'm the public health physician, part of public health, is that public health traditionally has been very patronizing in its approach. You know, don't stop smoking because it's bad for you, and that's sort of obvious. Well, clearly it's not obvious, mm-hmm. nor is in terms of because a lot of people still smoke anyway, and therefore the approach is has to be quite different, which is then the community approach. So yeah. Public health as part of public health approach is a challenge. You have a question, sir.
Thank you, Dr. Kelleher, for mentioning the smoking issue. You were talking earlier about how vital partnerships are. An interesting point, really, the history of smoking. A great movie came out called The Insider, talking about how they finally had these cigarette manufacturers confront the fact that they did have research that they were hurting people. And in the movie, they mentioned how 60 Minutes blew the whistle on the story. The truth of the matter is it was actually 60 Minutes quoting W5, because in America, it's against the law to blow the whistle on big money. So it was a Canadian company that 60 Minutes quoted. Anyway, with respect to partnerships in the community, I work in funeral service. We have the only family-owned funeral home, proper funeral home, at least left in the city of Vancouver. And that's a result of some pretty poor regulation. So I get flown all over to other provinces and states to talk about how family enterprise can engage with the community and survive Wall Street. And yet, when it comes to advanced care planning, I can't think of anything more sensible for funeral homes to participate in than that. And because I've been blessed with meeting a lot of other people, we came up with the idea, and I got Carrie Hoffman on side with Fraser Health, to do a talent show promoting advanced care planning with the idea of us having some acts tonight. I sent out an invitation to 4,000 family funeral homes across the continent and got exactly no response whatsoever. And I mean, this is an offer, an invitation to people in the, you know, end of life, the funeral business, to sit down with the people who are talking to 70% of our client base and have an intelligent discussion about moving this incredibly important issue forward. And I got no response. Plus, it went out on Speak Out and it went out on the American Network to 2,000 hospice organizations. There was no interest. The four acts we have tonight are all local. How do you do it?
Thank you. Thank you. Important question from one important part of death and dying. Any comments?
Well, I think as part of the tools that we're testing, some of them will be these public engagement things to start the conversation. I remember years ago I was chair of something and similar issue was very little uptake. And asked this person and said, you know, if you were in my position, what would you do? And she said, you have to create demand for your product. And so that's when you engage the public. And so much advanced care planning now is less about filling out forms and all about preparing people, moving them through the behavior change cycle to actually be informed, engaged, consumers of healthcare who are asking good questions and making the decisions that are right for you about goals, priorities, trade-offs, best possible day, really understanding the decisions that they're making. So I think there's a lot of opportunity here for people to understand the benefits of what we offer, but obviously we've got a long way to go.
Maybe I can pick up on that in terms of the long way to go. Don't despair, because we're just at the beginning of this. Yeah. It takes a long time. If you look at the tobacco issue again, really what I think made the shift in tobacco was the Non-Smokers' Rights Association, who turned it into not whether or not you should smoke, but whether or not as a non-smoker I have a right to clean air. And that changed the whole discussion. And we changed the social norm. 30 years ago, there'd have been ashtrays on all these tables. Now you would dream of it. It's the same with gay marriage. You know, we've changed the social norm. But it's taken 20 or 30 years for those things to happen. It doesn't happen overnight. And what we're talking about here is, again, changing the social norm from having sort of ignored death, denied death, to accepting death. And that's going to take a number of years. It's not going to happen overnight. But, you know, run the competition next year, maybe you'll get 6 presentations and 8 the year after, and, you know.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
And we just hope you like what we came up with. I know you have
to leave it. Alan, do you have any?
I echo what Trevor said. I always remember the gay and lesbian march in Sydney. It began with 50 people, half of whom were arrested at the end of the night. And now there's tens of thousands of people who do the gay and lesbian march in Sydney. It's an item on the world tourist map. I agree with Trevor. I think it's not so good now. Next year it'll be better. Next year it'll be better again. You know, the funeral industry, you know, from country to country is quite different, but it's been, it's often a private industry to start with. It itself has been fairly insular in a lot of ways as well. It's been the victim of a lot of stigma and social rejection, particularly from palliative care people who've treated them not so well in a lot of countries as well. So there's bridges to mend and bridges to extend, and this takes time.
It's a bit ironic that birth and death is something that applies to us all, yet we have a remarkable ability to ignore it. Next question.
Hi, I want to say thank you for your presentations this morning. Starting with Dr. Hancock, I get to go back to my community that has a health network that's done strategic planning about the 12 determinants of health and has said, no, we're talking about prevention, disease prevention. And there was a long silence in the room when I said, well, we're all going to die sometime. But so some useful tools there, and certainly very, very provocative material from Dr. Kelleher in terms of you know, I come from a community hospice. We think we're very linked, but we've become over the years more and more focused on providing certain types of high-quality service and perhaps gotten a little bit further away from really trying to support what it is people want and need. I'm not saying far away, but maybe there's been a little bit of a drift towards professionalization. And just in those terms, I just wanted to make a comment in terms of language. In Dr. Barwich's presentation, and part of the shift I think we need to make, I heard you know, something about the dying they, and in fact, it's the dying we, I think, that we want to be thinking about. It's all of us, and it's not so much that them us thing. And a comment about, I believe, good palliative care. We manage their pain, or their pain was managed. And again, I think the role is perhaps more of helping people to manage their own pain. That it's a, how do we really engage? So it's a huge shift, I think, in terms of how we think and what we do, and starting with our language, right? I'm working on it. So thank you all.
Thank you.
No question there, sorry, but I'd love to hear what you have
okay.
to say.
I appreciate the comment. Okay, we'll go to the next question.
Hello, I'm Leslie Rogers from the Fraser Northwest Division of Family Practice. We're a collection of some 240 family physicians in New Westminster and the Tri-Cities, and are working on a community-based model to build community awareness, to support healthcare providers in advanced care planning, and to construct the systems that will assure that patient information or public information about advanced care planning wishes are transferred from conversations around kitchen tables or at family practitioners' offices to the acute care setting and back again, so that that's the statistic that Dr. Barwick provided that shows that only 35% or so of wishes that are articulated actually end up on the charts. So I wanted to just say a couple of words about our initiative and then ask a question about the panel's response to this. So in partnership with the City of New Westminster, who proclaimed April 11th Advanced Care Planning Day in New Westminster, we hosted a fair, an advanced care planning fair, with another partner, BC Centre for Palliative Care, where our approach was to take advanced care planning and move it from something that was moribund and fearful into something that was celebratory, like a fair. So we had stations around the room that were staffed by people who, by medical practitioners, physicians, who could talk about those questions. What kinds of care procedures, end-of-life procedures, what does it mean to be intubated? What does it mean to be on dialysis? Where are the trade-offs between quality of life and quantity of life? We had people talking about, if you don't want to talk about this yet, just come and talk to us, talking about sex won't make you pregnant, talking about advanced care planning won't kill you. So, and we moved throughout to all of the steps in advanced care planning, right up to choosing a substitute decision maker and recording preferences. So our approach with the community and engagement with people in the community to talk about how to approach advanced care planning is to move away from the focus on forms, the focus on advanced directives, to starting the conversation. And so I want to share with this lady who had the question about where are some easy-to-use materials available. We developed a simple card that has conversation starters for the kitchen table, and then a list of resources on the back for more detail. And that more detail can include my voice, because that is a comprehensive resource, but maybe not the entree. So my question is to the panel, the description that I've provided of how we're approaching this from the ground up. How does that fit with your understanding and experience of the need to embrace partnerships to make all of this a community-based approach?
And how is it part of a public health approach, too?
Well, we distinguish. I mean, the public health palliative care network in places like Western Europe distinguishes between community-based work, community engagement, and community development. And we recognize that there's a lot of community-based work being done, particularly by services, to provide opportunities for the community. But what we encourage is partnerships in planning and provision. So your example sounds terrific, and I'm hoping that at least half the planning committee for that was the general public, and that when you had the festival, that at least half the community were talking about their experiences and their practices around support and challenges and things like that. Assuming that was the case, we would consider that a terrific community engagement exercise. If then you let it go and the Chamber of Commerce then ran it for the next 5 years, or the police service, we would consider that a major public health victory for you.
Trevor.
This may sound a little strange, but bear with me. In listening to Alan, somehow what popped into my mind is a wonderful Australian health promotion approach called men's sheds. Not many people in North America have heard of men's sheds, but the issue was all of these guys who retire and who are at a loss for what to do. They have no role, and they're under their wives' feet at home if they have wives, and they want them out of the house because they haven't been in the house really for 30 years. They've been working for 40 years. And someone came up with this brilliant idea of men's sheds, and basically that's what it is. It is a shed somewhere in the community, and you put in some metalworking tools and some woodworking tools and the coffee pot and whatever, and you open it to men. And they come, and they start to do stuff together, and they build community, and you use it to work with them and so on. And it's a very simple way of connecting in really quite a profound way. It's a group who are really neglected when it comes to health promotion. You know, I mean, it's an odd fact that we don't talk about much, but men die younger than women. And that sort of gets lost somewhere. So when we talk about I once in a conference, I was talking about inequalities in health, and I got challenged by a woman in the audience who said, "I didn't hear you say a single thing about gender inequality." Obviously expecting me to talk about women's gender inequality. And I said, "You're quite right. It's really shameful that men die younger than women and have more ill health. And we need to do something about that gender inequality." Anyway, that's kind of an aside.
Keep going, John.
But my point is, do we need life completion sheds in our communities?
Yes, the question is, when the men in the sheds, either they take up Morris dancing or they start talking about end of life, or both, maybe. Doris, do you have anything?
I think just very quickly, I think the emphasis on advanced care planning is a strategy of engagement of our public, right? Because I think there's three key trajectories of how we die. One is sort of the cancer trajectory. The emphasis was on pain and symptom management, and we would integrate sort of goals of care conversations throughout. Things happened fairly quickly. We have a sort of set idea. 80% of people who die in the future will not die that way. They will kind of be interacting with the healthcare system, and as they tell us, on the day before they died, they had a 50-50 chance of living for 6 months. So advanced care planning is about anticipating that you may not know when that day is going to come, and if you're waiting for that, you may miss the opportunity for the kinds of conversations that you want to have, et cetera, et cetera. So it's just a way of saying, let's talk about this early. Let's talk about it at a time when it can make a difference to how you navigate the healthcare system. And for people with dementia, you have to talk about it early or they lose capacity to have their voice inform the process. And you need to support caregivers because they're bearing the burden of care over years. So depending on what population you're talking about, there will be different emphasis. So I think community initiatives like yours, which are really starting conversations, broadening the conversation. I mean, there were, 250-plus people who came, and the excitement in the room was palpable. People, generally, whenever we've talked to the public, they want to talk about this, but nobody quite knows how to initiate. And so the more we can be just making it a comfortable part of what we talk about, I think anything that we can do to make that happen is a good thing.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
I'm Ross Sharp. I'm an academic surgeon. And I was very pleased to see in Dr. Barwich's slide a large circle which said education of healthcare professionals. I am very concerned about the woefully inadequate education of healthcare professionals, not just in this province, but elsewhere. And I'm wondering if the panelists could give their views on what can be done to improve this, particularly the older practitioners who got almost no training in there, and even now it's still woefully inadequate.
Thank you for the question. I mean, obviously, respond. I'm standing here so I can have time too. But I also lastly realized is that the professional physicians especially have very little time with patients, and they do not see them afterwards. They don't see them after surgery often, and they certainly don't see them after other forms of care. So I think is a hugely important question.
So I'll just let you know what the stats are. So currently a survey we did showed that out 10 out of 17 medical schools had less than 10 hours of palliative care, designated palliative care education within their curriculums currently. And so there's been a huge push nationally to introduce these kinds of discussions into the curriculum, not just of physicians, but nurses, social workers, of every healthcare provider. So obviously it needs to start at the undergraduate level. The other thing that we're finding is we're so short-staffed with palliative care workforce that we've really just been looking at patient needs. But if we're going to educate everyone about an integrated palliative approach to care, that's going to require a lot more people than we currently have to educate as well. And there needs to be this emphasis on education. And then obviously practicing professionals, I think they need to be encouraged. It's been hard to do that because largely the people who come out are the people who are kind of the converted and want to improve skills rather than the people who are really bad at this and really need the training. So all the advocacy can help my comments. Thanks.
Trevor? Alan?
Yeah, I mean, it is a massive problem. Yeah, I suspect it's bigger than you even think. I mean, there's no doubt that in medicine, palliative care, palliative medical training is lacking at undergraduate and graduate levels. It's not particularly well served in in-service professional development programs, and it's important that happens, and not just in medicine, but of course all the other healthcare professionals as well, social work and psychology and so forth. And they all have a similar problem. In a lot of countries, they don't have a national curriculum in palliative care. Let alone an interdisciplinary curriculum. But it's slightly worse than that even, in the sense that if you examine the curriculum that is available, and I've had a look at quite a few of them in Britain and in some countries in Western Europe and Australia, the teaching about what dying is like is almost, it's from lacking to missing. I've actually seen a palliative medicine curriculum with no lectures on dying. And if you do a content analysis of palliative medicine journals, the majority of articles are on symptom management and health services issues. They're not on dying. And it's one of the great ironies of the palliative care world, and has led, I think, to how runaway the assisted dying movement has gotten over this, is that at the very heart of all our debates about how to care for the dying, how to assist dying at the end of life, and how to age well, there's virtually no attention to what dying is like. So there's a lot of death education that needs to go back into palliative care curriculum. A lot of palliative care needs to go back into health professional and in-service development. And again, in public health education, palliative care is missing. So it's an octopus. It's a huge problem. And although Doris is right to emphasise that the curriculum problems in terms of staffing, to talk about who's going to do all of this, there are alternative models. We can use critical reflection training, for example, and capitalise on the experience of social work students and psychology students and even medical students about the death-dying experiences they have and work that way. So we don't actually have to have a whole new army of palliative care people to do this. it helps, but there are alternative models. But it's a massive problem, and I agree. I can't do any more than agree.
And I think it's a, even in some ways, a more profound problem than that, if I can say, because I trained in England, and I can remember one of our professors of medicine who said that the secret of medicine is masterly inactivity, that what you should do is nothing, and that you go to medical school for 6 years to learn when you stop doing nothing. And I've always thought that was the best advice I ever got, but I think that that comes out of an understanding, and I certainly feel in my training was that medicine is an art with scientific underpinnings. The problem is that certainly in North America and increasingly around the world, medicine is a science. And so people come at it as a science with a set of technical fixes. And the art has gotten lost. And part of that art is the art of dying, if you like, or the art of being well, or whatever you want to call it. But that, so there's a profound cultural shift that has to happen within not just medicine, but the healthcare professions more generally. And I don't quite know how we do make that happen.
Well, and I think the first step has to be we need to lobby the professional associations for a curriculum. That has to be the first thing. No matter how bad things are, we do need the Canadian Medical Association to take this on board seriously. We need palliative care education in undergraduate programs, not just 10 hours either. Serious.
It would also seem to me the ideal situation where you have health care students, but also other students within a university context, social sciences, for example. Because if this is a community approach and a part of healthy public policy, then it would be an ideal situation to actually put them together because it applies to them all. Anyway, thank you for your question, sir.
And that's the most powerful learning is when we learn together, right?
Correct.
Kind of challenged a bit in terms of our boundaries or our understanding of our role discipline, and we hear from others who see it quite differently.
We have 3 more minutes. I'm actually going to say one thing, actually, to throw this out, is that my recent experiences in West Africa reminded me that, yes, you can plan for death and dying, but there are a number of situations where you can't plan for it. And obviously, traumatic death, death resulting in infectious diseases, outbreaks and such like, can be hugely challenges to individuals and societies, and that's certainly true in the West Africa Ebola outbreak, which then was challenging from a social, cultural, and a broad variety of contexts. And that's something else I think we probably have to throw into this conversation, is that, yes, it is about planning, but planning for whatever form death takes, if that is possible. Different, but important. If there are no more questions, I think Lorraine's going to tell me that we actually are about time. So thank you all for participating in the discussion. Thank you very much for the presenters. Thank you for the association for promoting the public health approach.